Finance will come to order. Senator Hoffman, Senator Stedman, Senator Co-Chair Wilken, and myself, Senator Green, are here. We're joined today by Senator Gary Stevens. I don't see anyone else in the room. I'm sure some are listening, and they are welcome to come in if they choose to take part in the committee process today. The agenda for today really covers the next sort of step along the way, and it's the board restructuring. And anyone have any questions or announcements or whatever before we begin? Okay, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This morning, what we're going to do, as mentioned, we're going to go through the board restructuring concept of Senate Bill 141. And rather than do an overhead, as we go forward with these other sections, we're going to try to keep the slides number down, and we're going to try to just do it as a flip through. With that, I'll start on page 3, and there should be ample copies at the door. Slide 3 shows the current structure of the retirement system organization, and on the left-hand side, well, it's separated into two compartments. One's the left and one's the right-hand. On the left-hand side is the Department of Administration, and on the right-hand side is the Department of Revenue. And we'll start on the left. The Department of, under the Department of Administration, we have the PERS and the TERS boards. And we also have kind of the line going down to show the Division of Retirements and Benefits with Mercer and the accountant, Deloitte and Touche. But under the PERS and TERS, we have the primary board responsibilities. And for PERS, it's to adopt the PERS policies and regulations, act as an appeals board, which roughly consumes the vast majority of their time. They set the annual PERS employer contribution rate, and they adopt the actuarial assumptions. For the TERS, it's very similar. They adopt the TERS policies and regulations, act as the Board of Appeals, set the annual TERS employer contribution rates, and adopt actuarial assumptions. So the similarities are extremely high between those two boards. Over in the Department of Revenue, that's where we find the portfolio administered by the Treasury Division, and it's the Alaska Pension Investment Board. They have the Investment Advisory Council, and then Callan Associates is their consultant that does their performance comparisons. And their primary responsibilities is establish the investment policy and manage the investment for the retirement trust fund, which is highly related to the contribution rate and the actuarial assumptions, which is the bottom two items under the PERS and TERS board. Next page, on page 4, the retirement system oversight should be designed to guide and evaluate system performance, provide long-term strategic and financial planning, ensure the assets and liabilities of the system are balanced, implement formal system of checks and balances, and work in the best interest of the state and its public employees. And if I could back up to the middle item, where the issue is to ensure the assets and liabilities of the system are in balance. Currently, I think we'd all agree they're not in balance. There's some magnitude of imbalance of roughly $5.7 billion. Primary role of managing these assets and the liabilities is to keep those in balance. And unless you have a system designed to do that, the chances of it just happening by happenstance is slim to none. Next page, on page 5, the retirement board must be representative of all system stakeholders, experienced and knowledgeable in relevant financial accounting and investing issues. And on this issue, it's very important that the people that sit on these boards understand and comprehend not only the financial arena, but also can read and digest the actuarial analysis so they can be fully engaged in those areas of discussion. Empowered to address system problems. Impartial. Include non-beneficiaries and independent. Impartial and independent is not only very important for the boards concerning the state retirement system, but it's also important on virtually all boards in the private and the public sector. Page 6, Senate Bill 141, the board restructuring is designed to strengthen the fiduciary oversight of the retirement system, place system assets and liabilities within the preview of one authority. Right now we have a substantial communication issue and policy issue discussion on the table of what I would categorize as the a lack of communication between the ASBIB board and the PERS and TERS board. And a classic example of this is when we sit at this table and we ask a question and we don't get an answer. All we get is finger pointing. It's the other board. No, it's the other board. No, it's the third board. No, it's the actuary. Well, we've had them all in here. And we've gone full circle. And that doesn't facilitate a good public process. Increase the frequency of review, adopting and reporting the actuarial assumptions. The issue there is when, by unfortunate circumstances, we may get, off course. The sooner the system realizes they're off course, the easier it's going to be to get back on course. Increase employer and non-beneficiary representation on the board. Currently, the employers who bear the brunt of the liability exposure do not have, in my opinion, enough representation on the boards to make the policy calls. When you have boards that make policy calls disconnected from the group that bears the liabilities, you have an issue. Establish minimum professional qualifications of board memberships. Senate Bill 141 has done that. What we're gearing up for is to move it out of the political arena and make sure that every member has the professional qualifications to understand and comprehend and digest, formulate independent opinions, not only on the actuarial data being presented, but the portfolio presentation information, and grasp the concept that you have to match your assets and liabilities in the long run, or you have substantial problems within your plan that'll have rippling effects for decades, years if not decades. Move the quasi-judicial appeals process to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Currently, the PERS and TERS boards spend the vast majority, maybe above three quarters of their time, on appeals. It's basically an appeals board. The appeals process in Senate Bill 141 is moved over into the Office of Administrative Hearings. That leaves the PERS and TERS board with setting actuarial adopting the actuarial assumption rates and setting the contribution rate, which are actually areas that I mentioned earlier that should be sitting over on in the board that manages the portfolio, with the overall goal there is to keep the assets and liabilities in balance. So by moving to the Office of Administrative Appeals, pretty much removes the vast majority of the workload of the PERS and TERS board, and the other two items remaining left are certainly, in my opinion, should be the preview over on the investment board side. So therefore, those boards basically are rolled up and we end up with one board. Empower the commissioner of administrations to set policy and regulations for the day-to-day system operations. The new board will be concentrating on managing the assets and managing the liabilities, and over the long run, matching the assets with the liabilities. The next page, page 7, has a structure of the retirement system organization proposed in Senate Bill 141. Over at the Department of Administration, we have the Office of Administrative Hearings, Hearing Appeals. And I think they're going to testify either today or sometime in the near future, hopefully today, there'll be a member here. And I think what they're going to be telling us is they can handle the appeals process. That's what they're set up for. And that's where the normal appeal process is in the state system. The Division of Retirement and Benefits will adopt the policies and regulations. And that'll take care of the administration, Department of Administration's involvement. The Department of Revenue, there'll be a new board created, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and it'll be under the Department of Treasury, or the Department of Revenue, the Division of Treasury. They'll have an investment advisory council, they'll have their investment consultants, and they'll have their actuary. And when we sit here and have our annual reviews, and we look down the table, we're going to have one board sitting at the end of the table that will be interfacing with us to answer our questions. So if we have questions on the liabilities, or we have questions on the assets, or we have questions on, you know, a mismatch, or are we shallowing the hole, are we digging it deeper, you know, what kind of policy implications are we faced with when somebody comes here with a bill to propose a change. We'll have one board to issue our questions to. The consolidated board's responsibility is to manage and invest the trust assets in a manner that is sufficient to meet the assets, to meet the liabilities and obligations of the system. Currently, I think the language is something to the effect of total rate of return. That'll be embedded under this. This will be an overriding policy. Their goal is to match the assets and liabilities. They will no longer be able to sit, with all due respect to ASGIB, at the end of the table and say that they made their 8.25% target or whatever target they happen to have. I think now if it's 7.88 or 7.88, whatever it is, they met their target and everything's fine. Everything's only fine if the assets match the liabilities. One of the things that I think is very crucial and important for ASBIB and this proposed board, or Retirement Investment Board, we are not in any way suggesting that they raise their performance targets and change their allocation of assets. They seem reasonable. Some of us, you know, we've had discussions here at the table as far as their risk exposure. Some of us feel that they have a little more than we'd like to see. So it should not be construed that the portfolio policies should be set in a manner that would increase the risk exposure in the attempt to close this $5.7 billion gap. I think if we went down that road, it'd be extremely dangerous, and we'd have a high likelihood that the portfolio would blow up and we'd end up with a bigger mess. So I just want to make that clear to the Treasury people, if they happen to be sitting in the audience, that is not our intent. And if the board decided to go down that road, I think we'd be asking them some questions about why they're increasing the risk exposure to the potential detriment of this system. Yeah. And again, the idea here is an asset liability match, not an asset liability mismatch, and that's why the verbiage is changed. They're to establish investment policies and options. One of the, under the options side, one of the issues there is when they come in, we'll have a discussion and we'll work together as a group to, you know, work through this situation and get this gap closed to whatever magnitude we decide policy-wise collectively that our targets will be. We'll set the annual PERS and TERS employer contribution rate and review and adopt actuarial assumptions. And if I could back up for a minute, to set the annual PERS and TERS contribution rate, it is critically important when you have the assets matching the liabilities that you don't have an entity setting contribution rates that may be detrimental to that. We've got language in the proposed bill to block the contribution rate being set below the normal cost rate. And that is intentionally put in there. We have got to have a system in balance. We cannot have multiple boards setting different directions. In review and adopt actuarial assumptions, the new board will then be reviewing and adopting the assumptions from the actuary and working with the portfolio policy to hopefully grow the assets and the liabilities, and preferably the assets in a perfect world, faster than the liabilities. Currently, it's reversed due to the escalating growth rate of healthcare. And so from time to time, there's going to be imbalances in the growth rates. And again, I just, you know, sometimes I think I sound like a broken record, but I want to repeat that the whole concept here is not to turn the system upside down and escalate the contribution rates to the sky and move the portfolio allocation to the riskier asset classes, hoping we're going to close that $5.7 billion gap, because that's not a prudent way of doing it, and nobody sitting at this table, I think, would stand for that. The board.
Senator Bundy had a question.
And a question about the board. Thank you, Madam Chair. With the tens of thousands of teachers in Alaska and the, there's some 43,000 active PERS and 30,000 retirees, you're likely to find someone that would meet this requirement that they have recognized competence in investment management, finance, banking, economics, accounting, pension administration, or actuarial analysis. But what happens if we don't find a PERS or a TERS member that happens to have that kind of expertise?
Well, I think, Senator Bundy, if I recall from the language of the bill, and we'll go in and check that, I think those two members have a little looser criteria. Their main criteria is just that they're a member.
Okay, thank you.
The goal here is to have the board, again, the appeals process is taken out of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, put over in administration. So that issue is not an issue that the board's going to deal with. We're going to have an independent body dealing with that. And then most, you know, the membership is set up so the PERS and TERS employees and retirees employees have a member sitting at the table. But the responsibility of meeting the liabilities is a responsibility of the employer, just like we talked yesterday. When the system gets out of balance, you do not go back to the employees, extract a higher contribution rate to pay for an unfunded liability. So if the employer has a responsibility, regardless of asset performance, regardless of inaccurate growth assumptions or growth rates in the future of healthcare, they need, the employers, need to be sitting at the table overseeing and calling the policy shots. So with the new 9-member board, we have the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Administration or their designee. We have three members of the public having to be Alaska residents who are not beneficiaries of the system. And then we have a finance officer of a political subdivision and a finance officer of the school district. Yesterday, we happened to have one from the school district on the board, CPA. A fellow like that would qualify easily. And now, as mentioned yesterday, you know, we're going to have amendments to the bill, and you know, we're certainly open for ideas and amendments, and nothing's set in concrete. But clearly, the people that have the liabilities need to be able to call the policy shots. They get stuck with the bill and have no control.
Yeah,
thank you. I certainly don't disagree. I support that in its entirety. And I'm pleased to hear that the PERS and TERS member has a less rigorous qualification to be members of the board, because it just limits their talent pool if you're ready to wait till you find a PERS member that has these other qualifications.
Senator Hoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aside from the commissioners, what's your position on having any of these rest of the members being elected?
Well, I think they should be appointed.
All of them should be appointed? And confirmed, or?
Appointed. Certainly, there's been, you know, testimony from at least one person, maybe two, asking about the TERS and PERS folks being elected, and I think maybe a better approach would be to have their organization submit a list to the governor, and the governor could pick.
And that's where it would end, or would they have to be confirmed by the legislature?
I don't think there's any confirmation in this.
I think this is somewhat akin to the permanent fund board, investment board, and without confirmation.
They're three-year terms. Could have three terms, is that correct? Yes, three terms, and then you have to have a year off. So we're going to have new blood always injected in. You know, you could serve 9 years and then take a year off and reapply if you so choose. There's also been some interest in talk about the Commissioner of Health and Human Services sitting on this board. That's something we should talk about. The reason there is the health care cost issue. I assume he'd be more knowledgeable than probably anybody on the board, at least a good chance, on those issues. And if that is an issue that we're struggling with, then we should consider that and possibly move the three members of the public down to two, or do some other modifications on this list. I hate to see a board, this is a personal opinion, but I hate to see a board, the number of the board members swell to the point where it becomes unmanageable. I think smaller boards, or a 9-member board, is more effective than a, you know, an 18-member board or something like that.
Senator Bundy had a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just pointed out on the bill, page 36, under section 40, item B, it does not, in my initial reading, seem to broaden out the qualifications for the public employee and the teacher employee representative. And so just call your attention to that. And if that's your intent, maybe we could
we'll modify.
Make some adjustment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just keep it in mind. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your comments are right that it is very much akin to the permanent fund board. Senator, how are these folks going to be compensated? Is there some thought to that?
It's in the bill. I think it's the current rate, which is $150 a day.
Is it okay? So they get a per diem. Okay. All right. And regular travel and things like that. So there's something over and above just travel.
That's great.
Okay. Thank you.
There's a lot of responsibility with this board, and it would be nice to, you know, have a stipend and and attract quality members. I'm sure there'll be some prestige sitting on a board like this, but it's also quite a public service commitment to come onto a board that's going to have this type of a challenge. And I think we'll have enough qualified people stepping forward because we're all in the same boat, just like mentioned yesterday by Senator Bundy, that these are the funds of the people of the state of Alaska. So it affects everybody from children to our seniors. So I think we're going to have people coming forward for the board.
Senator Wilken, you might refer to Section 43 for that information.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Senator.
With that, I think I'll move on to page 8.
Senator Stedman, just for your information, Terry Thurbon, the Chief Administrative Law Judge is here prepared, for Office of Administrative Affairs, here prepared to testify. So when you are ready for her, we'll let me know. Okay.
Maybe it would be appropriate just to have that testimony now.
Okay, Terry. Just give your name and who you represent, please.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Terry Thurbon, the Acting Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I was invited this morning to speak to how Senate Bill 141 would impact the Office of Administrative Hearings. But first, I wanted to address the point that Senator Stedman made, which is that, yes, in fact, we would be able to handle this hearing docket. This is not the types of hearings that occur under the current PERS and TERS board system are not unlike a variety of different hearings we are already conducting and will be conducting in a broader universe of appeals that will be coming to us starting July 1st. We have complex occupational licensing cases. We have factually complex but legally simple permanent fund cases, and it can be the reverse. We have factually simple but legally and equitably complex child support cases. We have a whole variety of cases that we do already that I think would not be very different from the kinds of cases that I understand this bill would send to our office. And essentially we have three types of cases. We have what you might call the direct appeals, the mandatory referrals, and the discretionary referrals. And just let me dispense with discretionary referrals for the moment. Those are the cases the agencies don't have to send to us, but they want to take advantage of the service we offer. Those would be done under those agencies' own procedures, and we do even have some of those types of cases now. The bulk of our jurisdiction, if you will, our case docket right now is in the mandatory referral category, and those appeals are subject to some very specific procedures that were put into law last year, the provisions of which will be effective July 1st of this year, that provide for a very time-efficient process meant to get from the initial referral of the case all the way to the end in about 165 days, sometimes less. And those are sort of the lion's share of our docket. Then we have the direct appeals. And right now, the only category of direct appeal that is filed directly with us, not referred either voluntarily or mandatorily by an agency, is the tax appeals that we have taken over from the old Office of Tax Appeals. My understanding of this bill is these cases would be maybe a hybrid. They would be a direct appeal in the sense that they would come directly to us. And also, like with the tax appeals, our office would be the final decision maker before the matter could go on to Superior Court. But they're sort of a hybrid in that there's nothing in the bill that exempts these appeals, these categories of cases, the PERS and TERS cases, from some of those what I'll call efficiency procedures that were put into Senate Bill 203 last year. So while this would be similar to the tax docket in some respects, I can't imagine why we wouldn't be able to apply those same sort of streamlining procedures meant to get the cases from beginning to end in 165 days, the procedures that allow parties to I think the language is change the administrative law judge one time each side, a peremptory challenge, those procedures that have been accepted from the tax docket for reasons of complexity and needing special expertise and that sort of thing, I don't see why those same procedures couldn't apply to these categories of cases. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Do you have an idea of what volume this would bring to your office, and would it be such that it would require additional staffing?
Through the Chair, Senator Bundy, my best estimate based on speaking with people within the division and within the Department of Law is that there probably would need to be some additional staffing in terms of administrative law judge time. It's always very dicey in a sort of moving target docket such as we have, whether that really means a new hire versus being able to spread the docket around amongst the administrative law judges we have, and then at some point when our docket as a whole reaches a critical mass, then we add a person, as well as whether from time to time we sort of pick up the overflow by having a non-perm position or even a contract administrative law judge. But it is in the administrative law judge area that we're already pretty busy, and that I expect that we wouldn't be able to totally absorb all this caseload, especially in the early startup period. I understand there's a bit of a backlog with some matters that haven't been sent on to the boards yet for reasons that I won't go into, but that cleaning up that backlog could take a while and could take a little bit more time than in year two and year three and in year four. I don't see any reason why we'd have to add additional administrative staff, but probably some additional administrative law judge time in the area of perhaps as much as a full-time equivalent for the first year, and then maybe a two-thirds to three-quarter time in subsequent years. That's my best estimate based on the past history as well as what this bill would put in our office that is presently sort of split between the board's functioning itself, the board's contract legal counsel, and then the division staff that does the case workups and the scheduling and that sort of thing.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Wilkin, did you have your hand? Okay. I'm going to ask you one question. Is there anything about the language in this legislation concerning the Office of Administrative Hearings that could be improved? Is there anything that you might like to see stated differently, and certainly get that information to us? And
well, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to do that as I study it a little bit further. The language itself at this point isn't at all troubling to me.
Okay.
There are some differences in what this bill would do in terms of the authority that it would give us. They're a little different from some of the other dockets that might cause you to want to consider, for example, are you going to want, because we're the final decision maker, that we have a certain level of expertise, such as we do with the tax docket. That's something. I don't feel that is necessarily required, but there are some issues, if you will, that might come up in terms of the way in which this is a sort of a hybrid direct and mandatory referral appeal system. And I'd be happy to look at that closer
If you would get the language to either my staff or to Senator Stedman and Miles Baker.
Certainly. I'd be happy to do that.
Whatever works the best is certainly what we want. Are there any other questions? Well, thank you for being here, Terry, and we appreciate your testimony. Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair, that concludes my opening remarks. Certainly the last presenter did a far better job explaining her department than I could, and I appreciate her comments, and I also appreciate her willingness to work with the Finance Committee and polishing up this Senate bill.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions on the administrative hearings segment of this? Have a brief at ease. So, Senator Shedman, did you have anything else to present for today, or should we go to public testimony at this point?
I'm finished for the day, Madam Chairman. Just make one quick comment. There's been a few questions that come up, and they'll come up every day, and we're going to try to get the other senators their answers. We've got some stuff coming, being prepared for Senator Hoffman and also Senator Wilken. And when we get those polished up, they should be today, we're getting delivered to your office. And just as a general comment to the senators, we have lots of backup information. There's no secrets. We'll give you anything or everything we have.
Thank you. I think we'll have a wealth of information and more than enough sheets of paper before this is over. There are a couple of members in the from the boards who were on the tier review, Brock Jorgensen and Dr. Soli. Would you mind coming forward, please? I don't know if you're actually prepared for this presentation, but we can get you to talk about the process and your conclusions and the tier restructuring effort you put forward, because we've heard great reviews about it, and certainly I think you'll see your handprint very clearly on the language that is in this legislation, and would be delighted to hear from you. Dr. Soli, if you could introduce yourself and who you represent, please.
My name is Richard Soli. I'm retired from the University of Alaska, where I was a professor of economics, head of the Department of Economics, and acting dean of the School of Management. And I also had my own economic consulting firm for a number of years. I'm a member of the TERS board. I was appointed by Governor Murkowski in the summer of 2003 and then reappointed to a full term in 2004. And as a member of the TERS board, I did serve as one of the four members on the TIER committee.
Could you tell us anything about the experience you had and how you came to the conclusions you did? And if there's any information you can share with us, or if you see us going awry or astray on any of these things, if you could just kind of help us out and certainly in future get us any information you might have. And today, if you want to have any thoughts you want to share with us, please.
Well, I do have some thoughts. They're general. I personally had not planned to speak very much to the reorganization because I think some of my colleagues have spoken significantly to that. I do have a few comments on that, but I was going to focus on some of the other issues.
That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I will, since the focus of this particular session is on board restructuring, I'll make just a few comments on that. And in my testimony, I had written out a draft of what I was going to say. I'll undoubtedly depart from that. But I organized some subjects in order of what I considered the priorities to me, and I had the reconstitution of and or elimination of the boards down in third place. Because there were some other things that I considered more important.
Do you plan to share that written document with us?
I don't have enough copies. I will have a copy that I can give to the committee.
We could have staff make copies and distribute it at an appropriate time for you.
Sure.
So just so we have it in our file. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see if I... I've got it in here someplace. I've got a marked-up copy here. That can I get it to you afterwards?
That'll be fine. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me just make a few comments about the reconstitution of or elimination of the existing boards. And I would have to say that, in general, I probably don't have as strong opinions on this as some of my colleagues, and that's one of the reasons that I put it down in a lower position. I feel that the increased emphasis on professionalism that is proposed in the new structure would be a positive factor. Very possibly the emphasis on at least some degree of input from the general public, I would see that as a positive factor. I have some questions about the balance there, because I feel that the PERS and TERS boards, as they're structured now, are trustees of the funds. These are funds into which the members have contributed. They're funds which really represent the retirement for these individuals, so it's an extremely important thing for them. And as a consequence, I feel that majority representation on the part of persons in those systems is not inappropriate, but I also don't feel that it's inappropriate to have public representation of individuals who are not part of the system. I also feel that it is not inappropriate to have employer representation on it. So taxpayers, employers, then the members. But I think there should be a significant representation of the members for the reasons that I stated. I have some concerns about the appeals process. I would really make only one set of comments on that, and that is I, for a number of years, was a member of the National Panel of Arbitrators of the American Arbitration Association, and I'm sure that most of you are familiar with that organization and the way that it functions, and in most instances, the arbitrators hear cases as a single arbitrator. So in that sense, there's a similarity to what there would be in the hearing officer approach. In addition to that, the arbitrators very often are hearing cases in which they have no specific expertise. They're going to bring a general expertise, but not necessarily a specific expertise, and certainly they're not generally members of the peer groups who are the appellants in the issues. But there is one significant difference between the situation with arbitration as it typically applies and the situation proposed here, and that is that the arbitrators are selected by the two parties, so that each side has to agree upon the arbitrator. And as a consequence, the arbitrator has a basis for trust on the part of both sides of the issue. In this situation, as I see it, the administrative hearing officer, as I understand it, is housed in the Department of Administration, and it would be hearing appeals of issues that had been decided by the Department of Administration. And I find that to be a real concern. I think that that process would lack confidence on the part of the individual appellants. And I think that that could have a very damaging effect on morale. Now, frankly, when I came onto the board, first of all, let me say that I'm on the TERS side, and TERS doesn't get nearly as many appeals as PERS does. And I think a significant reason for that, I would like to say it's because teachers aren't so troublesome, but really I think that it's because on the PERS side, the majority of their appeals relate to disabilities. And the disability issue is not nearly as significant on the teacher side because of the nature of their work as it is on the PERS side. So I haven't been involved in very many hearings, but to be very candid, I expected the TERS board to be what I would call bleeding hearts with respect to the appeals. I didn't find that to be the case. I found them to be very rigorous in their judgments, and in fact, in the cases that I participated in, they upheld the administration in all of those instances. So the concern that I had on that part didn't hold true. I can't really speak for the PERS side of it, but the impression that I get is that they bring a similar perspective. Departing from that, there are a couple of issues on the financial side with respect to the new board. Incidentally, one other thing that I guess I would say on that the appeals process is that really, as it is structured at the present time, the TERS and PERS boards represent, in effect, a jury of peers. And that concept of a jury of peers certainly has a hallowed place within our society. And so I don't think we should cast that out lightly. On the financial side, I'm especially concerned about this idea of the matching of assets and liabilities. On the face of it, I would have to say that it has an appeal. But I'm not sure what it really means when you drill down into this issue. When you look at the issue of dealing with the liability side, obviously the determination of benefit levels is a significant factor in determining liabilities. The boards essentially have no authority in that, and I don't believe that it's intended that the new super board would have that responsibility. That's basically legislative. In terms of determining the benefit provisions, the provisions of benefit plans. I mean, that's one of the things that it's my understanding that the legislature is dealing with here. And I'm talking about benefits primarily on the retirement side. On the health care side, there's a significant administrative component, but again, it's primarily administrative or legislative. Some of the elements would be legislative and some of them would be administrative. But it is not the board's purview to make those decisions. The boards may recommend. And if you look back at the history of the PERS and TERS boards, you'll find that they have made some significant recommendations that have been very cost-saving, and there are a number more that have been placed on the table by the boards. But the role of the boards in determining benefit levels, I think, is minimal. But the role, the place where they would play a role is with respect to the actuarial assumptions. And the TERS and PERS boards at the present time do have a responsibility for reviewing the actuarial assumptions and for monitoring the performance of the actuaries. And obviously there have been some problems with that in the past. And I would hope to see that aspect of it improved. I'm not sure that shifting that to a super board would improve that because you would be loading that responsibility on top of an already heavy responsibility in terms of the investment of the funds. So I don't really know that that situation would be improved. I think that possibly increased professionalism on the part of the existing boards might help there. And in that regard, I'd have to say that I've been very impressed with the boards as they are currently constituted. I think that having people with a stronger background in some of the issues that the actuaries deal with would be a positive factor in assisting in that monitoring. When it comes then to the liability side, I'm not sure what would be improved with this super board over what could be done by possibly getting people on the boards who would have more of a background in those specific areas. I think that could be helpful. As far as the other element in the matching of liabilities, the rate of return that is assumed is a very critical component. And an increase or a decrease in the assumed rate of return can have a tremendous impact on liabilities, on the estimated liabilities, the actuarial liabilities. It doesn't make one bit of difference as to what those liabilities will be in the future. they're going to be as are set forth in the plan documents. But all that it makes a difference in is the current estimate of, let's say, the present value of what those future liabilities will be. Now, I'm concerned if, in the concept of matching the assets and the liabilities, that means that the super board would look at the situation and they would say these liabilities are very high. And in order to meet them, we're going to have to go over on the asset side and we're going to have to raise the discount rate. By raising the discount rate, you reduce the liabilities and you also increase the projection of assets. So you can solve a lot of problems, apparently, by playing around with that discount rate. But if the board were to decide that the discount rate needed to be raised in order to meet the liabilities, the only way that the board, that the super board, could actually accomplish that would be by increasing the risk involved in the portfolio. And I think that would be very, very dangerous to place that responsibility on the super board.
Yeah. Right. I do want to say something, Dr. Stolle, because I think Senator Stedman kind of touched on this the last couple of days, of which you may not have heard. And I'm going to give him the opportunity to explain what he's talking about the matching of assets to liabilities, and I don't think it had anything to do with assuming higher risk, and I think he spoke to that this morning, and he's iterated it several times. Senator Sim, can you kind of say the different things we were talking about, what they would bring to the legislature as possible solutions or steps that we could take, they could take, any of us could contribute to the solution? Can you go through that listing?
Let me just touch on that, the discount rate issue and the issue of asset and liability matches. There's numerous different strategies one could run in a portfolio, one of which is a total rate of return with a targeted rate, which happens to be 8.25% right now. There's also, other ones. Let's just leave it at that. And the issue, like I mentioned earlier, to fund that $5.7 billion underfunding, mm-hmm. I would happen to agree with you that you cannot do funny accounting by increasing your targeted rate of return, your discount rate, mm-hmm. from 8.25% to say 9.25%, for example. Mm-hmm. We'll just use a 1% increase. What that does is it, like you had stated, it shifts your portfolio into more risky asset classes, increases more volatility, and then subjects the overall asset liability mismatch to more variability, and we could just as soon blow it up as sit here. Mm-hmm. Now the discussion of heading down that road, if a board, whether the super board or ASBIB for that matter, decided to go down that policy road, I think they'd find considerable objection from the people that have the liability exposure, which is the state. So I am concerned that targeted rate doesn't start chasing after this hole, this $5.7 billion. There's other mechanisms we're going to have to sit at the table and discuss in the future to deal with that particular issue. But if we, for the sake of conversation and clarity, if we assume that there was no unfunded portion, that the liabilities, in fact, did match the assets and we were in balance, there is strategies and policies that can be put in place to control that risk exposure on the downside. Downside meaning an asset liability mismatch, to go apart. There is several challenges, one of which is the growth assumptions in healthcare. I think a nice way of looking at that is what happened to the savings and loan industry about 20 years ago, when they went into a situation where they had a classic asset liability mismatch and it blew the whole industry up. And the government had to come in and basically absorb it into the rest of the banking system. So, you know, I agree 100% that not the way to deal with this situation is to increase that discount rate by putting direct or indirect pressure on whatever board, ASBIB or the new consolidated board, you know, to chase that. And one of the responsibilities we have as stewards for the state is when the board comes in to have them justify that targeted rate. The concern I have under the present system is you have ASBIB sending the actuary the target rate of 8.25. Then the actuary, or through PERS and TERS board, however the actual mechanisms get it to Mercer, then Mercer has this discount rate. The discount rate isn't necessarily set. In fact, it's set from the testimony.